You're listening to the Business for Good podcast, the show where you'll hear inspirational stories about companies making money by solving some of the world's most pressing problems. I'm your host, Paul Shapiro, and I'm glad you've joined us. All right, friend, welcome to episode 141 of the Business for Good podcast. This is the ninth in our popular 10-part series featuring pioneers in the cultivated meat movement. Now, before we get started, first, please let me briefly apologize to our German listeners who contacted me about my error in the last episode with Uma Voetti from Upside Foods. I mentioned during that interview Potemkin villages, and I said I couldn't remember if they were from Russia or Germany. Indeed, they were Russian. I included a correction in the show notes at businessforgoodpodcast.com for that episode and a link if you want to learn more about the very interesting history of Potemkin villages. But I'm correcting my ignorance here too by affirming that they were indeed part of 18th century Russia. So please, thank you. Sorry. Glad to all of you who pointed it out. Now, there are many updates to the new paperback edition of my book, Clean Meat, and one of them is the inclusion of a really cool company called Orbillion Bio. If you've not yet gotten the updated paperback Clean Meat, what are you waiting for? And if you did read it and want to learn more about Orbillion, now is your chance. If you follow the cultivated meat sector, you already know that the last couple years have been tough. Some companies have gone under. Others have gone into hibernation. Others have shed staff and cash-conserving layoffs. Major publications have published opinion column obituaries for this industry, yet the work goes on. Part of that work is that of Orbillion Bio, a B2B cultivated meat company which successfully raised capital in 2024, defying the odds, surely a Herculean feat, and evidence that this company is not presiding over a Potemkin village. This is particularly relevant to my era since Orbillion Bio's CEO is actually originally from Austria, which was part of Germany during the time of Russia's Potemkin villages in the 18th century. So, having brought in $15 million, while the Orbillion technology is complex, the business model is simple. Grow high-quality Wagyu beef cells and then sell those cells to others who will create finished goods with them. In this conversation, Orbillion Bio's CEO, Patricia Bubner, and I chat about what makes them different from other cultivated meat startups, her work as a plant and fungal biologist prior to her career in mammalian cell culture, what she thinks are the best ways to scale, why she thinks this was successful in fundraising during a time of real funding famine, and more. So I now bring you Orbillion Bio CEO, Patricia Bubner. Patricia, welcome to the Business for Good podcast.
Paul, thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here forward to the conversation.
I have known you for a long time. Actually, what feels like a long time because I've known you since before you started this company. But you were not always so into animal cells. You used to be more of a fungal, right? You were not a fungi. You were a fungal working in the world of filamentous fungi. And you had a deep interest in plants and fungi, but we'll get into how you got out of those kingdoms and into the animal kingdom. But first, why plants and fungi? What were you doing in your life that led you to want to get into the world of plant biology and filamentous fungi and other cool things that I love?
Well, actually, I mean, you kind of alluded to it. I've been all over the place in technology, but it all had common thread. And that thread for me was food. And how can we use the technology that we have to make better food? That's why I initially studied chemical engineering, which doesn't make sense to a lot of people. But for me, it was always clear if we understand the molecular basis of nutrition and of food, then we can make healthy food from scratch. So that was kind of the thread through all of that. And it started with, you know, kind of second generation biofuels, because I loved the technology to make environmentally friendly fuels in a way. Now, you know where that ended, but it brought me to UC Berkeley. And that's where I got, besides fungi, also into plants. And as you know, fungi played a big role in biofuels, and it actually crafted the whole industry and the efforts in biofuels. A lot of good people came out that now work in a lot of food companies, and that makes me very happy.
Yeah, even at my own company, the Better Meat Co., we have people who worked in biofuels. So we have one, our head of engineering worked for 6 years at a company trying to make fuel from cyanobacteria. Their company went belly up, as did so many other biofuels companies, unfortunately. But it did produce this cool generation of people who want to use biotechnology.
What a great lesson.
And Mike,
isn't it a great lesson, though? You think things are going south, but, you know, from everything that kind of gets destroyed, something new can grow. So
yeah.
I think it's a great life lesson.
Yeah, indeed. Well, you know, people tend to learn more from failure than success. But let me just offer a quick side note here, because I want to make sure for listeners that they hear you saying fungi and they hear me saying fungi. And I want you to know, I've talked to many mycologists who say both are appropriate. Now, I don't know why anybody would say fungi when they say fungus and fungal, why it switches to fungi. Like, why would you switch from fungus to fungi? But they are both equally acceptable. And apparently there is even, it's like a British versus American English type thing, because they say fungi in Britain. They don't say fungi or fungi, they say fungi. So anyway, yeah, both are apparently acceptable. Do you have thoughts on this, Patricia?
Not many, other than that I had the discussion early in my career and I asked for advice and settled on fungi.
Wow. Okay. I think
Do we want to continue this discussion with how we call cultivated meat? Because that could take up the entire time here and people might get bored.
That is an interesting discussion about nomenclature. Maybe we'll get into that, but
please,
I will say in the world of mycology, I will say, like, it does seem like the cool people that I know tend to say fungi. I don't know why. I think it is not logical, but anyway, I gave up on trying to be cool many decades ago, so I need not worry about this. So I want to go back to your pre-Orbillion life real quickly. So you're working with fungi, you're working with plants, doing biofuels, but somehow you became obsessed with millet. The grain, right?
Oh, you remember that part.
So if you look at your life, a lot of it was devoted to millet. And, you know, many people, like, you know, Jane Goodall was devoted to chimpanzees. And, you know, you got other people who are devoted to one thing. You were devoted for millet for a long time. So tell me, why millet and what were you trying to do with it?
You know, I think the fascination came from really, how can we create food from scratch? It started, you know, with me trying to do a lot of things from scratch, made my own sourdough before it was cool. And then you go further and you're like, oh, but I make my own sourdough. I make my own malt. I want to grow my own grain. So I know what, you know, the soil, the microorganisms in the, and so on, as a scientist, the data behind it and the trial and error and all of that that's involved was very fascinating to me. And when I came to the US, I realized very quickly that the food system here is completely different. And as an avid reader, I read John Steinbeck, which I'm sure many of you know and appreciate. But the takeaway for me was an understanding of how the US food system is different from the European food system and why we eat the way we eat and why we grow food the way we grow it. And that is really a consequence also of the industrial revolution. If we look at our food system right now, it's heavily dependent on fossil fuels. Fertilizers is one obvious one, the use of tractors, machinery, and so on. So this is like a compounded problem of fossil fuel use, land use, monocultures resulting in more fertilizer use, resulting in more land use. And then we end up using a lot of that food that we produce to feed animals or make biofuels. And that's full circle to where we started. I was in biofuels and we started talking about the food versus fuel problem. So speaking about monocultures and corn, there is very little variety in the food we grow and eat. And there's a reason for that. There are scalable systems that were developed in the mid-19th century. The wheat belt started to emerge and so on. And we got better and better in growing one type of food. And that also, of course, led to us consuming certain types of foods and not others because they were more widely available or we found ways to make them stable. And one thing that's missing is that diversity. And that has a lot of influence and of course, effects on the way we eat and our nutrition, especially in the US, but also globally, really. because the US is also, of course, an exporter, global exporter of important foods. So millets, something that the rest of the world, or not the rest of the world, but it's a grain that has been around for thousands and thousands of years. They call it an ancient grain. It's really a loosely related group of grasses with seeds. And you find them in Asia, you find them in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, and they are super, super interesting because they are naturally drought tolerant. They've never been really bred for certain traits, which is both good and bad, because it means also they're not the high yielding industrial crops that we need, but also they have still a lot of these intrinsic really conditions or traits that we now can use to learn from. And so in the US, millets were only used or are only used or mostly used as bird food. And I was like, wow, how is that? And we started still at UC Berkeley. We started the Millet Project, me and another chemical engineer. And then, you know, I think I'm probably the only cultivated meat founder that can really claim that I planted multiple fields of grain, both millet and corn. And one of them, even with a very interesting method, there was a horse-drawn plow there, which is actually still very useful for small plots that just it doesn't work to have a tractor go there. So I think that experience was super, super important for me also to get deeper into the reasons of why we grow the foods we grow and how to sell them.
Interesting. So we will link in the show notes at this episode's on businessforgoodpodcast.com to the Millet Project. But the tagline is rediscovering the traditions of cultivating and consuming millet. So because it's drought tolerant, I presume you think, you know, this is a better crop to base our food system on than something like corn. Is that right?
Look, the way I think about the food system is that it is not one thing. It's a very complex system, and we need to think of it as, you know, anything that we change, it's a dial, not a switch. It's not a switch from one thing to the other. It's a dial. And the more things we bring in that might be suited for different geographies, for different, maybe changing climates, the more resilient that food system will become. That's, of course, also where cultivated meat comes in, right? It's one of many things that I believe we need to make a future-proof food system that doesn't cause the planet to burn.
So what led you into this? I'm glad you mentioned cultivated meat, since that's obviously the whole purpose
already,
of our conversation.
Like 10 here, minutes in, yeah. People are like, wait, what? She's doing fungi and plants and
exactly.
Millets, but where are we? John Steinbeck?
All right. I do want to get into cultivated meat, obviously, but
that's how I got into cultivated meat, because I wanted to get into cultivated meat.
Wow. Okay. So, you know, there's lots of ways to try to peel this potato, so to speak. If the concern is, you know, we need to find more efficient ways to produce protein, you've got companies doing plant-based meats like Beyond Meat and Impossible Foods and Gardein and so on. You got other companies like Corn, Q-U-O-R-N, making mycelium from filamentous fungi. And then you got other companies that are growing animal cells, which is kind of the furthest off from being commercialized in any meaningful way. So why choose that route? Why did you think, hey, I don't want to do plant-based proteins, I don't want to do fungi-based proteins, I want to do animal cell culture?
Okay, I'll share a secret with you and everyone who listens to this.
All right, I'm ready.
I'm a nerd. I am a scientist. I'm a nerd. I was always really interested in technology. And I also want to make a meaningful impact with that science. Otherwise, I would have stayed in academia and done a lot of the research that is so important to do at the ground level, right? The basic research. And I wanted to see how can we apply technology. How can we apply that very, very interesting science? And that is why, you know, the Millet Project was great. And I think the bigger, more important transformation that I can do with the scientific background that my business partners and I have was cultivated meat. And also, I told you in the beginning that I was always really fascinated in nutrition and how we can make food that is perfect, both in flavor, taste, texture, and nutrition. And cultivated meat is so much more than we barely scratched the surface. Amazing technology. I think there's so much to create and discover. So that's why I'm really excited and passionate about this field and about bringing in particular my experience in my business partners, my team's experience in that comes from the deep science side, from the industry side. We have scaled things to create this very new technology. And going back to the dial and not switch thing, I think it is critical to create that technology. I think it's critical that we have that technology in the future also available at scale. And I think that Urbillion, that we have a very specific way to get there and very special insights in how to bring that to scale and to market.
It's actually the very next thing I wanted to ask you, Patricia, is what makes you different from any other cultivated meat company? But before I ask you that, what does Urbillion mean? What does the name come from?
So that name comes from really our technology. And of course, that we wanted to scale that to really bring it to as many people as we can.
Ah, I see. The billion in terms of the number of people who you're planning to serve here. Okay, cool.
So you can also say, you know, in the number of, you know, first sales or whatever. A lot of uses. You can make of it what you like.
The number of people you'll serve, the number of animals you'll save, the amount of dollars you're going to make. Okay, great. All right. So how are you doing this? You guys claim that you have this predictive process that cuts down on R&D time. So tell us about that. Like, what makes Urbillion different from any other cultivated meat company, aside from the fact that you've been growing exotic animal meats as opposed to chicken or pork or beef, right? So but what's the technological difference in this predictive process that you have?
So I think the first important clarification is there. We are a beef company. So we want to become one of the biggest beef companies in the world. That's our goal. We start with what we believe is the best source of cells, which is Wagyu beef. And that is really our goal. It's also the biggest impact that one can have in term really on the intersection of cultivated meat, food, technology, and climate, I would say. So I think we quickly realized that beef is the most important product, in our opinion, that you can make. And we make a ground beef product. That's another important point, because we also want to go to market really fast. And we want to create something that is 100% experience for the customer, which means we can make a beef product, a ground beef product, that is just like the ground beef product they're used to. Personally, I don't believe that for hardcore meat eaters, other technologies for structured meats are there yet at this point. And so we were always focused on getting to market as fast as possible with the best product we can. And yes, you said it, we built this predictive model that helps us to really scale faster. And the proof point there is that we did a 200-liter scale-up run, even at a funding level that was before a Series A close. We were arguably the fastest company to get to such a scale, with also the capital efficiency that we displayed. And that's because our really model around BioWare, focusing on the process, the inputs, the cells, the data that we have around our process, that enables us to really scale in pretty much any setting and adapt the process to any bioreactor, any scale-up facility that we want to use. And that was the proof point. We scaled in a very short time, 90% less time than anyone else, using that exact model, verifying that model. And we're already working on our next step to next step of scale.
Great. So you mentioned that you have produced ground beef in a 200-liter cultivator. And I've read in interviews that you're saying that you believe that you can get to good economics, like actual good margins, in a 20,000-liter reactor. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah. You know, also the background that we have, that the entire team has, comes from bioprocessing, partially, of course, biopharma industry, where also the team's experience is, where my experience is, where my co-founder's experience is. And this is important because what we're building is really something that has been done for decades, which is cell culture. We're just using different cells than typically are used. That is the major difference there.
And so if I read correctly in the news, your next step is you want to go from 200 liters to 2000 liters. Is that when you say you're working to the next step? Is that the next level for you?
Yeah, we definitely want to go to pre-commercial scale and then the next step up to commercial scale. So if you think about, we did our first scale up step that was 100x. I mean, that's a huge step up. The next step, it's only 5 or 10x, you know? And then there's another 5 or 10x to go up to the next step. So
what is commercial scale for you, not in terms of reactor volume, but in terms of pounds of product? And I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
When Josh Tetrick was on this podcast a few episodes ago in this Cultivated Meat series, he said that for Good Meat, his aspiration was to build a factory that could produce about 30 million finished pounds of cultivated chicken. Now, that would not be entirely animal cells, but presumably it's majority animal cells. But still, it's 30 million pounds of product produced annually. Is that what you think of when you think of commercial scale for Orbillion? Or do you think of something greater than that, less than that? Like, how many pounds do you need to be at before you can figure you're going to get to a break-even point where you can actually be making profit?
Oh, I love this point, Paul, because it tells me one other thing. There's no standardization, right? In this industry, currently, there's no standardization. We really need that on a lot of levels. And you're right. So thanks for asking for clarification there. For us, and we talked about that before, the first commercial scale will be roughly 4 million pounds of finished product per year.
And is
but
that...
But please don't hold me to that by the pound. Can you promise me?
Got
that?
It. Yeah, so, you know, look, you know, business plans rarely survive first contact with reality, but you can always plan, right, and what you aspire to. So nobody's going to, or at least I'm not going to say, hey, back in 2024, Patricia said 4 million, and it turns out it was 3 million. You know, what, you know, she really pulled the wool over their eyes. So, but if 4 million pounds of finished product, is that entirely animal cells? Is it a hybrid product? And if so, is it majority animal cells? Like, what is 4 million pounds of what type of beef?
So that brings me back to what I said earlier, right? The potential of cultivated meat, we barely scratched the surface. I think the way we understand the field right now, we talk about cultivated meat. What does that mean? Again, no standardization, right? And then there are various people trying to describe what they're doing. What we manufacture, what we produce are beef muscle cells, beef fat cells. And we've gotten very, very good at scaling them with our really unique algorithm for cultivated meat that is in the future expandable to other mammalian cells. And what the finished product is, we're a B2B company, right? So that's what we are selling. Whatever will be done with that product is really the customers. Customer's kind of realm, right? So of course, we could also deliver a ground beef product that is finished. But we all know that the way we produce cultivated meat right now, and that comes to what the industry does, is the first thing we really need to do is we need to make enough cells. And in the end, the product that we have and that we had in tastings has less than 7 ingredients total.
Okay. So if you are selling cow cells, like cow muscle cells, as a B2B ingredient, what do you anticipate is the selling price for that? Like, if I am a food company and I want to buy the Orbillion cow cells, is it something like $10 a pound, $100 a pound, $1,000 a pound? I don't mean today. I mean, when you're making 4 million pounds a year.
So the way we think about the industry is the reason why people buy certain products, besides of marketing, is a lot of availability and price point. And of course, taste, hugely important, right? So if we can make a tasty product at the price point that the customer will buy, then, you know, that is pretty much the goal. And for the comparison that we have right now, ground beef, right? We know that the pure COGS calculation is pretty straightforward. We can get down if, you know, everything goes well, meaning supply chain is built up, we are at scale, we can run consecutive reactor runs. In our model, we can get down to a price that's absolutely at price parity with mass-produced beef. Will take a while, of course, because we need a fully fledged facility with, you know, 10,000 liter, 20,000 liter reactors, and it is possible. The other thing is we can start, of course, at a premium price with the initial products that we have to have these margins, and also looking at what else can our cells provide besides, you know, being a fantastic ground beef product. And that's what I'm talking about. We barely scratched the surface. There's okay. so much that we can do in terms of, I mean, we just learned about this huge beef recall because of contamination with fecal bacteria, right? We won't have that. And that is really a huge promise. There's this factor of automation in food production where we have a product that's every time the same. Our customers can rely on the flavor, taste, composition. It's always the same, which we don't have in animal products.
Yeah, I was thinking about what you were saying, Patricia, with the fecal contamination. And, you know, this is one reason why the Good Food Institute was popularizing the term clean meat for so long, because, you know, conventional meat has fecal contamination. Salmonella, Campylobacter, E. coli, these are all intestinal pathogens that can sicken us if we don't literally cook the crap out of the meat. You got to cook the crap out of the meat. Whereas with meat that you grow in cultivators, you don't have to worry as much about fecal contamination from intestinal pathogens because you're not growing intestines at all, right? Like you're growing muscle and fat. And so you're more likely to infect this meat with your own hands.
Actually, we don't have to worry about it at all. The contamination often happens in the slaughterhouses and in that process or in the packaging process. And in cell culture, all of that is strictly monitored.
Got it. Okay. I want to first congratulate you because you raised capital in a time when it's very difficult to do so. So it appears from that you had previously raised about $5 million, but recently you raised what looks like another $10 million. Am I accurate in that?
So yeah, we have raised a total of $15 million right now. Okay. And with that, we've really shown our capital efficiency, where we are at. Also at this point, I'm really proud of the team, especially the scale up that we've accomplished at this stage. And our next step is really to get to that next step of scale. We've done that extremely asset light, which I'm also very proud of.
So how do you do it? Is it because you're asset light that you can stretch dollars further? Like, you know, there are a ton of companies in the space right now that are struggling to raise capital. Venture capital funding is down. It's down for biotech. It's especially down for cultivated meat for reasons that we can talk about. But you defied the odds. You know, other companies have failed to raise capital and have either gone out of business altogether, like New Age Eats, or they've essentially gone into hibernation, like Finless Foods. Porter Billion was able to raise eight figures in a very difficult environment. So what advice do you have for others who are listening who think, I really would like to do what Patricia is doing and raise some capital for my startup? What advice would you give them? What do you do right?
You know, I wouldn't say that anyone has done something wrong, which that feels like it kind of implies to me. I think it is difficult times to raise capital. And then I never had the expectation that it would be easy to raise capital. I was actually a little bit surprised about the conditions that I found when we started Porter Billion and then went through Y Combinator. And I have to say that I have amazing investors on board, which is just great to have in these times, that also see the value that we bring and that see the technology also that we've built and the team behind that, that has been tirelessly working on that, right? So our approach that worked for us was always to put technology first and to build that technology. And that takes time, right? And then also to make sure that that has a product focus and a go-to-market focus and what is the best and quickest way to market for us with the best product that we can bring to market. So that worked for us. Going to scale worked for us. And that is really largely dependent. Do you have the right people on your team? Do you set the right milestones? And then can you meet these milestones? And do you have the right investors that can also value that approach? And yeah, asset light, I think investing in CapEx for equity dollars just didn't seem right to me. And the way I see the industry, if you compare it to animal agriculture, right? There is a lot, I mean, industrial animal farming is CapEx intensive. There's buildings like slaughterhouses, there's machinery, there's farms, livestock, all of that is very, very expensive, right? And who puts that capital in? It's usually not the farmers. It's big companies and strategics behind it. It's also the government. We know that this is a highly subsidized way to do business, right? So I think for us, the goal is to prove out the technology and find ways to work with the important partners that can help us to get the infrastructure in place.
Interesting. So you don't ever plan on building your own biomanufacturing facility in the way that...
Never say never.
Never say never. Okay.
I mean, maybe somebody comes up and says, Patricia, here you go. Here's, you know, the money you need to build your facility in LV.
Yeah. Okay. Because, you know, you look at... You know, you look at Upside Foods. We just had on last week their founder, Uma Vuetti, and, you know, he's talking about, you know, they spent $50 million to build their pilot plant in Emeryville. And Josh Tetrick said right now the cost to build the factory that they want is hundreds of millions of dollars, and he needs to figure out how to get it under $200 million. Presumably, if they thought they could take an asset-light approach and have somebody else put in that capital expenditure, I presume they'd be doing it. I don't know how they plan on doing this or not. But it seems like a tough row to hoe to figure out. How do you go from 200 liters to 20,000 liters, or as Josh Chetrick was putting it, you know, 200,000 liters? It seems like a hard thing to do. I don't know if you have thoughts about other ways of financing this if you want to take an asset-light approach.
Look, I mean, first of all, I commend everyone that is building in this space. It needs really a lot of companies. It needs a lot of knowledge to bring these products to market. And there's different ways to do certain things. We are a B2B company. Again, we're focused on a different type of customer also and different path to market. And I think there's many creative ways to finance bigger facilities, right? But what you need, of course, is a proof of concept, a proof that you can scale. And that makes sense, right? So we have that proof and we're, of course, working on building these relationships. We've published our collaboration and partnership with Leuten Foods, part of the Thomas Foods group that we're very, very proud of. We always are close to the traditional meat industry. Our advisor from the first days, Guy Crims, the master butcher from the Nico Steakhouse here in San Francisco. This knowledge is important. I mean, we're all on the same team here. We want to bring good food, meat to customers.
Why do you think it is that this industry, which a few years ago was attracting these mega rounds, hundreds of millions of dollars of investment for some of these companies in individual rounds, is now the subject of, frankly, what are obituaries from journalists? And there seem to be like a core group of journalists who continually write and rewrite the obituary for the cultivated meat industry. Why do you think that is? Like, what is happening that has caused some journalists to start saying this industry has died in the cradle?
The first thing when I read articles or comments like that is I would ask myself, cui bono? Whom does it serve? So I leave that open because I don't know. And so I think what we're focusing on is really building something real, building technology that is critical in a world that suffers from climate change that is caused by two major drivers of that are fossil fuels and land use. And so I spent my time on really solving that problem. Why or why not investors were or are interested in it? It's hard for me to tell. I'm not an investor. So I might not be the right person to answer that. What I know is that we have built a technology that can do so much more than again, cultivated meat, I think we really just are scratching the surface. Because if we solve the problem that we are solving right now, which is, can we grow primary cells that we take from a source to scale? There's a lot we can do. And we're building that platform, right? So I'm very excited about that. And I think the best way to prove that out is getting to scale and getting to market, which is what we're working on doing.
So how close are you to that? So companies like Eat Just or Upside Foods or Aleph Farms have received regulatory approval, either in the United States or in Israel or in Singapore. How close is Orbillion to receiving regulatory approval from the FDA and USDA? And I know you cannot predict the behavior of these agencies, but presumably you've already filed your notices with them, right? Is that right?
I think that's a thing that you need to ask the regulatory authorities. When do we get regulatory approval? Our goal, again, I think, of course, you need to have regulatory approval to sell, right? But then if you don't have anything to sell, that's also bad. So again, I think scale for us is the major focus right now. And then I think when you have scale and you have regulatory approval, then you can sell.
I got it.
One of those by themselves will not be the solution.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, you look at these companies bet on getting regulatory approval when they did get it, but now they're not selling. So, of course, it's great that they have regulatory approval, but you still don't really have any meaningful
and
sales.
And everyone has a different set of, you know, certain goals and timelines and where they started and what they're building. So that is fine. I think we're all, the more, and you know that, the longer you are in this industry, the more you learn. And that's what I tell the investors I talk to right now. Is like, there is no one that knows more about the cultivated industry than the people that are building it. So whatever journalists write, it will always be from the outside and it cannot be the inside account. And that is, I think, the difficulty also because it is such a new industry. And I'm delighted to see that there's now more academic research going on and we finally get this built out to get the real good broad acceptance and research that we need, frankly, to build this huge industry and serve billions of people.
How long before then do you predict? Of course, you don't have a crystal ball, but you want to serve billions of people. So how long do you think, Patricia, sitting here in May of 2024, before you think, let's say, a billion people will have consumed maybe not your product, but a cultivated meat product?
You know, I thought about that a lot. And especially in hindsight, right? It's easier to say, oh, this is what I thought would happen at this time. And this is what actually happened. Now, I don't know about you, but all the big things that happened in the last 4 years, I didn't predict a single one of them. So I'm really concerned about saying something right now, and then the next thing happens, and I'm like, oh God.
Well, I'll tell you, my powers of prediction are extremely poor. I remember in 2016, I told my friend that I thought that I had a better chance of being president than Donald Trump did when he was running. And I thought, like, he has a 0% chance, like zero. Like, I think literally I thought I had a better chance. And I, of course, did not think that I had any chance, needless to say.
But did you even run?
I thought I had a better chance even without running. That's true. Like, I thought my chances were about as close to zero as you could get. But I thought his were actually zero. And I was, of course, entirely wrong, needless to say. So, you know, look, I'm not asking you to make predictions that you're going to bet tons of money on. But if you had to look, you know, you look back, let's say 20 years ago, and people were predicting, where will electric vehicles be in 2024? I don't know if people would have predicted that you would have entire states saying they're going to phase out gas-powered cars. You have whole companies like GM saying they're going to phase out gas-powered cars. Do you think that's possible, that you're going to see meat companies saying they're going to, in 20 years from now, that they're going to phase out animal-based meat? Or do you think that 20 years is too aggressive of a timeline on that?
So the way I see it is, again, I'm going back to the dial, right? I think a resilient food system needs to have and needs to stand on many different pillars. I do not think that animal meats will be phased out. I don't think this will happen. What I hope is that we replace a lot of it with other products. And again, coming back to what I said earlier, why are we eating what we're eating? Because it is available, because we're using it, because it's broadly available. We like it. It's delicious and we can afford it. So the challenge that we have is, can we bring products to market that people love, that are nutritious, that they can afford, and that they will choose eating over animal-based products? I think that's a really good challenge to have. And I believe that a lot of products that we're working on now, including cultivated meat, is a fantastic solution for that. And then also, again, this world is complex. People are complex. The way we decide what we eat is complex. And there are a lot of places that do not have the land for animal agriculture, that do not have the resources for that. For whatever reason, we're cultivating meat where other ways to produce food would be such a benefit, because they would reduce the need to import things, a lot of transportation of live animals, which is also a huge problem, especially if you look into even Europe, Middle East, and so on. So many things that can happen. And I don't believe that there's one single solution that will solve it all. That would be too easy.
All right. You mentioned, Patricia, that you learn more the longer that you are in the space. You've now been running this company for years. So if you could go back and talk to the Patricia who had just started this company and say, okay, here are things that I've learned. Here are mistakes you shouldn't make. Here's some wisdom that I have gained during this time. What would be the lessons that you'd be offering to the first-time founder of a for-profit cultivated meat company, Patricia?
So one important lesson for me, for us as a team, is that it is really good to stick to the fundamental beliefs that brought you into this business. For us, it was really the belief that we can use technology to build a nutritious, delicious product, and also that we can do so based on the knowledge that we have from bioprocessing, from biopharma, from industry, from the science side, and also to not look left and right and get detracted or distracted by what others are doing or what others are saying, and focus on the building part and bringing a product to market. I think that is really important, and stick to the principles. What I mean by that is, we always believe that going for a product that's scalable is the most important thing. To bring a product to market that is equivalent in the experience for the customer and not anything less than is also really important.
Were there any resources that were useful for you? Like you mentioned John Steinbeck at the beginning of our conversation, but are there any other books or speeches or anything else that you have found useful that you'd recommend for others?
So I think in general, there were a lot of people that were excellent resources along the way. You were one, Paul. I mean, you remember when you met starry-eyed Patricia a couple of years ago, and I had a copy of your book. So thank you.
Well, I'm honored, and I'm very pleased in the new updated paperback edition of Clean Meat that came out in April of 2024 that Orbillion has a presence in the book. So who would have guessed?
Thank you for that. Full circle.
Yes. who would have guessed? But yeah, so what? I'm glad if I've played even a modest role in your journey, but what other resources would you recommend?
Yeah. So one thing, as a scientist, I'm always driven by, I'm trying to be a data-driven person, right? And one thing that I try to wrap my head around is, again, how can we make a dent with the technology that we're building and give a positive spin to the food system, to the environmental movement, and so on, and make a true impact? What is the best way to do that? And a book that I recently came across is by Hannah Ritchie from Our World in Data. And she wrote a book called Not the End of the World. And I'm really fascinated by the way that she presents the data, the way that she goes back to the data. And one thing that stuck with me was when she said that we actually have a smaller carbon footprint right now than our grandparents have. And she leads you to why that is. And one thing that I also find very encouraging is that we have built technologies that have helped us to reduce that impact, like the environmental impact, to make new materials, make new products, make things more efficient. And that is exactly my experience as a scientist and engineer. As I went through my career, I'm like, oh, we can improve so many things if you just put the time and effort and knowledge to it. And here's the thing. There's so many people out there, especially young people right now, that are so passionate about climate change, about making a difference. Everyone can really contribute. Learn something that matters to you and look for ways you can contribute. You do not have to found a company. There's so many ways you can contribute. And there's so many things that haven't been looked at. If you are the one to look at it, you might solve a really important problem.
Indeed. And first, let me say, I really enjoyed Hannah Ritchie's book, Not the End of the World, also. And I actually posted a review of it on Facebook that I will link to in the show notes for this episode at businessforgoodpodcast.com. But you mentioned that you don't have to start a company, but you could. If somebody's thinking about starting a company, what do you think they should do? Are there any things that you think need more attention that haven't been figured out yet that you hope someone listening will start?
You know, I hope somebody listening will listen to themselves and be like, that one idea that I have, that's the thing that I want to follow. And it's something that I find completely surprising. Because if there was something else that I found that fantastic that I needed to work on, I would do it. But I think that's cultivated me, to be honest, right now. Okay. And I think the important thing is if you really have the drive, that you have that thing that you want to build on, just go and do it. Give it a try.
Yeah, I always say, you know, people are like, well, what if I don't have the experience? It's like, well, how do you get experience? You do it. You know, if you want to learn how to play soccer, you don't read a book about how to play soccer. You get on the field and you start learning how to play and you practice. That's how you get good at it. So I think the same is so.
Just be ready to get kicked in the face.
Vera, you know, I could not come up with a better way to end it than what you just said, Patricia. So on that note, if you want to start your own company, get ready to be kicked in the face, just like Patricia Bubner. And I will look forward to following your progress. Congratulations on raising capital in a very challenging environment, Patricia. And I hope to get a chance to try some of your delicious cultivated beef sometime. And I hope I get to be there when you start selling your product by the kilo. It'll be a wonderful time. So congratulations on your progress so far and hope you get to commercialization soon.
Thanks, Paul. And of course, you'll be invited.
Okay.
Thanks for listening. I hope you found it useful. And if you did, please let the world know. Leave the show a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast app and share the episode with your friends. Who knows? Maybe you'll inspire one of them to be in the business of doing good themselves.